I would like to hear from all of you what questions you have or what topics you would like to hear about, and then I'll incorporate that into my conversation with you.
Let's give me you're ready to
okay. Any of the others?
Maybe
Natalie Houston.
Okay. Maybe about meditation and your stillness, your experiences with that.
Okay.
We've been talking a lot about bridging Eastern and Western wisdom, and just as an American now here with Swami, just sort of your experience with our two, I guess, ways of life, how we inform each other.
Okay.
Maybe you can speak of your experience or experience of your students, how to reach, how to build a spiritual discipline and inaugural discipline of your life.
Okay.
I want to hear about, before all of this, when your upbringing and when you came into being your name.
Okay. And what is your name?
I'm Amy.
Amy?
Yeah.
And we're beginning by hearing from you if you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear about.
I think I basically answered my question. I want to know what brought you to this.
Okay.
How you came.
Okay. And your name?
My name is Catherine.
Okay. And do you have any questions or topics?
Oh, I'd be interested to hear what brought you to this as well.
All right, that seems to be good place to begin. Maybe I should ask how much time you have. All right, well, I was born in, like most of us here, in Chicago in 1947. And then our family moved to the suburbs when I was 8. And somewhere around the age of 8 or 10, I had an inkling that that I was meant for something more than just the regular life that people were leading. I mean, I remember the moment very vividly, But at, you know, I was very young. I didn't have a clear idea of what it meant. And then, in high school, I was looking. I think at that stage, I was looking to do good for others. And based on my understanding at the time, which was based more on the body, I thought that the way to help them would be to become a doctor. So I became the president of something like the Future Doctors Association. And then I went to university. And there I found one friend in particular. I think he really made me understand this, that a person could be in good health, but the pain he suffers in his mind can be even greater than the pain that one suffers in the body. And at the time I didn't know it, but I think in retrospect he was depressed or maybe something like that. That was like in terms of others, and in terms of myself, I was looking for perfect happiness, and gradually I understood that. I was reading and attracted to different Eastern philosophies and disciplines. And then it all came together in the psychology department, which was under the chairmanship of a man named Abraham Maslow, who was developing what they call the third force in psychology. The first was like behaviorism, you know, like stimulus response, and then the other was psychoanalysis. So, yeah, his idea was instead of studying rats and sick people, he would study healthy people. And so he developed a whole theory, you know, a hierarchy of needs, and the idea of self-actualization, and peak experiences. But as far as my internal search, I came to understand I needed a teacher. I couldn't just do this by reading books. And then my focus became to find my teacher, my perfect master. So at the university itself, they invited a lot of yogis and swamis. In Boston there were many, and I went to see many. You know, there's something inside of me that made me keep looking. And then finally I decided I'm not finding it here, I'm going to go to India. So my best friend and I decided we're going to go to India after we graduated. And then, I think March 31st, my senior year, Srila Prabhupada came to speak at the university. And that evening I had planned to go with some friends to see a movie in Harvard Square. But anyway, I said, well, you know, first we'll go to the lecture and then we'll go to the movie. So we went, but there was quite a discussion what to do, you know, whether to go or not. Some people didn't want to go. So we got there late, just in time for the kirtan, the chanting. And it was amazing. Students were jumping up from their seats and leaping up onto the stage or climbing up onto the stage where Prabhupada and the devotees were. And it was like an amazing experience. The whole auditorium was reverberating, vibration. So then, but I hadn't spoken with the Swami. So I told the disciples I wanted to speak with the Swami. So they said, well, he's giving a talk. The routine was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he would speak at the ashram. And Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, he would speak usually at a university or else some other place. So I went, and then at the end of the lecture, I raised my hand, and this was really the question that was consuming me. I asked that there are so many swamis and yogis, and each one is advocating a different process of self-realization. Mm-hmm. And each one says his is the best. So how do I know which is actually the best? Then he replied, intelligently, with another question, which was, what is your goal? Because I was saying, what's the best end? Mm. And yes, self-realization is a general idea, but he said, what is your goal? Mm. Do you want to become God, or do you want to serve God? And he said, if you want to become God, that means you're not God now. And how can not God become God? So that God is always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna's God, and he's God when he's, you know, playing on the lap of Yashoda, and he's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, and you know, he's always God. And then he said, "If you sow the seed of service to God and water it by chanting, then God will provide all the favorable conditions to make it grow. But if you want to become God, why should God help the competition?" So, he said, you can become godly, but you cannot become God. And then he said, so what do you think? Do you, you know, you want to become God, or you want to serve God? Now, at that time, now this is a little, I want to say personal or subjective, but at that time, I had the distinct feeling impression that he was like seeing straight through me, seeing through the walls of the ashram, down the road to my apartment. And he was looking right in to my apartment, into my bathroom, to my wall, where I had written in my own hand, very ornate lettering in different colors, "You are God." That was to, like, in case I forgot, as I could remind me. So I thought, okay, well, this was, you know, this is my perfect master. This is what I was looking for. But then he asked me, so what is your goal? You want to become God, or you want to serve God? So I wanted to say I want to serve God. But I knew he knew everything. So I said, I want to serve God. But actually I realized I wanted to become God. I said, yes. And then I knew, you know, I found my master for whom I was looking. And then I think just one other, I mean, there were many experiences that sort of validated the process of bhakti yoga, which I really learned it's called bhakti yoga. And that was at one of the other universities. There were students, but also some faculty and staff. And at the end of the talk and questions and answers, there was a kirtan. And so we were like dancing in a circle in front of Prabhupada. And I felt like overwhelmed with feelings of love for, and I was just looking at the faces of the people in the room, I was just like overwhelmed with feelings of love. And then that feeling sort of extended beyond the classroom, the hall, you know, just into the neighborhood and across the country and into the universe. And I'd never experienced anything like that. And then, you know, being fresh out of the universe, there's, well, maybe I'm having a peak experience. It was probably, but more than that. And then I went up to Prabhupada. I was just like overcome. I'd never really gone up to him. I'd ask questions, but, and I said, you know, this chanting is wonderful. And he just chuckled in a way that I could understand. He was like feeling some like ecstasy. Mm-hmm. He just said, thank you very much. So then the next, there was a program at the Harvard Divinity School. And at that time, the devotees didn't have a car. The movement was new and they were pretty poor. They didn't have a car. I mean, they had some, like, different plates and cups. Nothing matched. And a lot of them, they had holes in their socks. And I said, you know, like, is this part of it? Like a vow of poverty. And they said, no, this is all we had. So they saw that I was coming regularly and that I had a station wagon. And so they asked if I would drive Srila Prabhupada to the programs. I said, yeah. So we drove to Harvard Divinity School. And there were a lot of, I remember the questions and answers, the students had some challenge, were challenging Prabhupada, you know, they thought they were pretty smart, but yeah, they probably were. But so one young man said, you know, you're saying that by chanting all problems will be solved, but in Russia there were people chanting the name of Jesus, but it didn't really change anything, and what really changed things was the revolution. And Prabhupada said, are the people in Russia happy now? He said, no. He said, well, what is the use of that revolution? Then another one, I mean, you're saying we should chant Hare Krishna, but couldn't you just as well chant anything repetitively? Mm-hmm. Couldn't you just chant 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada said, well, you can try counting, and after you're tired of counting, you can try chanting. So, it's sort of like one by one he was dealing with their questions. And then one fellow asked, you know, are you don't remember actually. It was one of those questions, either are you, I think, have you seen God?
Mm-hmm.
Or have you seen God?
Mm-hmm.
And Srila Prabhupada replied, if I tell you falsely that I have seen God, do you believe me? And the boy said, no. And he said, then what is the use of asking such a question? So, what I remember was the students were like quite buzzing like about the Swami's answers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sort of relishing, just wandering amongst them and hearing them. And then one of the devotees came running to me and said, Prabhupada is waiting to go back. And I had like totally forgotten. So I ran, got in the car. And when we got in the car and drove a little distance, I realized I didn't know the way back. Because during the day it was light and I sort of could find my way, but now it was dark. I didn't want to give in. So I kept trying to figure it out. But as we were going further and further, I got this sinking feeling that we're lost and we might be getting more lost. So I asked the devotees who had all piled in, does anyone know the way back? Nobody knew the way back. And then Prabhupada, he was like sitting in the passenger seat. He said, is not the driver supposed to know the way? Anyway, eventually we somehow figured it out and we got back. So then I ran and opened the door. And I said, I'm sorry that I got us lost. And he smiled, with such compassion and love. And he said, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that really touched me. Because I'd seen how he'd sort of disposed of all his students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he'd wanted to, he could have, torn me to pieces in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, it was like the perfect philosophy and the perfect process. He was also very compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
He can appreciate if someone's making an effort, even if it's faulty. So then, there was one other little experience, and then I'll move on. But I had also been experimenting with different types of yoga and things. And so part of it was a sort of like conscious relaxation. So one night the program went late. And the devotees said, why don't you just spend the night with us? So they were all like, they all just slept on the floor. That morning, the next morning when I woke up, I felt my body was like so relaxed. Like every single muscle seemed to be like completely relaxed. I thought, wow, it's like all my conscious relaxation. And it's like spending one night in the ashram. So I felt that. So then, so after about a year and a half, Prabhupada wanted to come back to India because he felt that the Indians were just trying to imitate the Westerners. And so if he brought some American and European disciples and they saw that they're taking to the original Vedic culture, then they'll imitate that. and it really was like that. I mean, when we came, I mean, it was very rare even for anyone from Europe or America just to visit India. It was like very expensive. It was just, it's like so far away. And so a lot of people have never even seen someone with bare skin. And then to see us dressed like in their traditional robes and not even just regular traditional robes, but sort of like spiritual traditional robes. I mean, people literally were like weeping out of joy just seeing us chanting in the streets. And then, well, other than you, they haven't met Radhana Swami.
No.
So I'll just add a little for him.
You were getting to that.
Yeah. So then Srila Prabhupada, in India, they have pandals. A pandal is like an open air tent, but huge, like they can accommodate, you know, 20,000 people. And so he thought, you know, we could do that. And so we had we organized one downtown Bombay, like the most prime location, just like right between the main business district and the train station. So I mean, people just during the rush hour when there were thousands of people would pass by. Yeah, it was a real event. And at that time, Radhanath Swami, who you will meet tomorrow, he had already come to India on his spiritual quest, and he had lived in the Himalayas, and he had come down to Bombay to deal with his visa. So he saw like these big banners. I mean, everyone knew about this program. You know, that there were banners, billboards, you know, Hare Krishna Festival, Cross Maidan with the dates. But at the end, people knew it so much that at the end we got like a huge billboard near the other big train station. And it just said Hare Krishna. It's like you didn't even have to say festival or the location or the dates. So he came in to the tent, and he was sort of dressed in simple white robes that matted hair. And I was sort of the manager of the site. And so we had a book table. And this is actually a major, you could say, part of our lineage. It places a lot of emphasis on literature. And so Srila Prabhupada's guru had told him, you know, if you ever get money, print books. It's a very major part of the, you could say, the extension of compassion and mercy to distribute literature that will enlighten people who they are and what their life is meant for. Mm-hmm. So, when I was in Boston, we used to go on the streets and I would approach people and I'd hand them a magazine and they'd look at it and I'd say, would you like to
keep it, and you know, just ask a small donation. So here I started to do the same thing, but it was different in India. People started to walk off with the magazines without paying. So I consulted some of our advisors. Oh no, you can't do that here. Okay, what do we do? So it said you have to drill a little hole in the corner of the magazine, and you put a string through it and tie it to the leg of the table. Because yeah. So, it has to go in their hand, they have to have a chance to see it. So, okay, you know, that's the way they do it, and we'll do it that way. So this young man, who later became Radhana Swami, he was coming. He was like spending most of the day in the pandal. So I asked him if he would like to do some service. And he said yes, and I explained, this is your service. Poke holes in the corners of the magazine and tie them to the legs of the table. So he gives me the credit for being the first one to engage him in service.
Yes.
And then there were other, there who were the first to like give him prasad.
Mm.
Do you know the word prasad?
Mm-hmm.
It's food that's offered to God. Vegetarian food that's offered with love and devotion to God. And then what's left is called prasad, which literally means mercy. Yeah, so. So now coming back to meditation, and like I mentioned, I was trying different types of meditation before I met Alpine. And he described, you could say, the effectiveness of chanting. It is meditation. But as opposed to other types of meditation in which the object of the meditation does not have any particular intrinsic value. The value is it is focusing the mind. But here, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, these divine names, sacred syllables, have an intrinsic value. And so meditating on those names or syllables has an effect that goes beyond stilling the mind and making it peaceful, but it actually brings one in touch with Krishna, with the Supreme. And in general, Bhakti Yoga, coming back to my original question and Prabhupada's question to me, do you want to become God or do you want to serve God? It's based on the conception of God being the Supreme Person. Now, of course, there are many statements in the Vedic literatures that refer to an impersonal feature. Like the light, like a spiritual light. And that feature does exist. The Vedic literatures don't deny it. But from the Bhagavad Gita through others, Srimad Bhagavatam, and it is sort of revealed that there's like the form of Godhead, and that's another topic, but the original is Krishna, but there are others like Rama and Vishnu. And then there are devatas, like demigods, like, you know, Ganesh, Kartikeya, who are not in the same category, but they are powerful agents of God. Like a king, he has his ministers, but there's only one king. And then there's Shiva, who's sort of in between. So coming back to the mantra. So these are names of God, but in a way, God has no names. But He has form, He has qualities, He has everything that we have, plus more. And so our idea is to develop our relationship with Him, and that relationship is developed by service. And chanting is included as a type of service. There's like 9 categories, shravanam, hearing, like you're doing now, you're hearing about Krishna, and in kirtan, part of your chanting, part of your hearing. So shravanam, kirtanam, Vishnu, to make it clear that it's about Vishnu, smaranam, remembering. And so this, it's like Srila Prabhupada used the term practical samadhi, that you can be busy the whole day in service to Krishna. It's not that you have your life and then you set aside a certain amount of time for your meditation. And it's even more than having a certain lifestyle that supports your meditation. But it's actually being engaged, you know, from morning to night in some service to Krishna. And that was really, really a very big thing for me. To be able to connect my daily life with bhakti yoga, with Krishna consciousness, with God consciousness. So it's really an adventure. And I welcome you all. I think I'll mention a little, although nobody asked it, but I think I will mention a little about Ayurveda, because I have a sense that you have some interest in Ayurveda. So I think this is also a divine arrangement, but you know, I was looking for a good doctor, and somehow I got introduced to a really good Ayurvedic practitioner who, this is another thing. Another very important concept in any Indian discipline, Vedic discipline, is parampara, which means the lineage. Like, who is your teacher? Who is your teacher's teacher? Who is your teacher's teacher? So, this Vaidya, this Ayurvedic practitioner, comes in a line that is traced all the way back to the time of Krishna. And it's actually mentioned in that family line is mentioned in one of the Puranas or subsidiary Puranas. So we've had many long talks. I've never really studied formally, but I've learned a lot from him. And basically what he told me is that in Ayurveda, the aim is not to
to treat the body, but it's to treat the person. And the person includes, you know, body, mind, and soul, atma. And many elements of the, you could say, yogic lifestyle are supported by Ayurveda or derived from Ayurveda. For example, getting up early in the morning. That's highly recommended in Ayurveda. In fact, this Vaidya told me that sleeping through sunrise is considered very inauspicious. So there are many things like that, even like, of course, being vegetarian, but like we don't eat onions or garlic. And generally, in no temple will you get prasad that has onions and garlic. Because those are sort of, they're like lower vibrations, you could say. And I met him at a stage when he was relatively new, and he asked me if I could provide someone to work in his office. And I said, you know, there must be so many people who just die to get to work in your office. He said, yeah, but they eat onions and garlic, and I can't have that vibration in my office. And, you know, I can't tell them. Now, you know, so many years later, they fully embrace the lifestyle, so that but that point, yeah. And he was saying that Western medicine, they've come a long way in understanding nutrition. But there's a subtle level that they don't have access to. So then, we'll come to the pulse. Now this is more for like practitioners. I mean, you can follow principles of Ayurveda in your life, but to actually act as a practitioner, you need to take the pulse. So I'll just say a few things about how deep that goes. So one day I wanted to fit in a walk before seeing him. He's also in Southern California. And so I did, I fit in the walk, and then there's a little traffic, and like between the exertion of the walk and the anxiety of getting to the appointment on time, I was like a little, say, worked up by the time I got to his office. So I said, you know, I don't know, like, I'm in this condition, it might throw off the reading of my pulse. And he said, no, I think he said there's like 12 levels of reading of the pulse. There's like the tissues, the organ, that just goes deeper and deeper, even into subtle aspects of your being, like your consciousness. And he said, only the most superficial levels will be affected by, you know, some temporary exertion, but he doesn't even really consider that. He goes for the deeper levels. And then he explained that, you know, he explained the different levels, and then he came like to sort of like the level of consciousness. And it's a very fascinating discussion. We can't get into it now, but eventually, I don't know if have you heard the term sattvic?
Yeah.
So there's these three gunas, tamagun, rajagun, and sattvagun. And he was explaining that through the pulse you can tell what guna the person's
in by nature. And then he was saying, even in sattva guna, there are like varieties of mentality. Like there's the Indra pulse. Indra is like a devata who enjoys like heavenly pleasures. So there's the Indra pulse, and that someone, he's in the sattva guna, but with the desire to enjoy opulence, not to enjoy pleasures. Then there's the Kuvera pulses, also in the sattva guna, with the desire to enjoy wealth. And then there's the Rishi pulse. You know the word Rishi? It's like a sage. And the Rishi, someone with the Rishi pulse, he is interested in self-realization. And no matter what happens, whatever happens on the various levels of his body or mind, he will never be deviated from his quest for self-realization. And then there's the, he said, the Vishnu pulse, which is like beyond this world, sort of a Shudasana. So, so one time I had we're intimate by now, so I tell you. Yeah, at one stage I felt like, you know, a number of symptoms of old age coming on. And it was just sort of in the back of my mind that, you know, do I really want to have to like go through all this? And, you know it's just going to get worse as time goes on. It was sort of there in the back of my mind. So, yeah, okay, and then he took my pulse and then he said, you know, even though there are difficulties in old age, you have a mission in life. And, you know, we'll take care of you as best as we can, but whatever the inconveniences are, you know, you have to fulfill your mission. And you shouldn't think of leaving before your mission is complete. So I said, wow, what made you say that? And that was like just what I needed to hear. And he said, I got it from your pulse. And there was another person I knew, like a devotee, well, sort of a devotee, who had a very traumatic childhood and was, and eventually became sort of, at least for a while, sort of like mentally unbalanced. And he said, I know about all that. And he really like described sort of what the trauma was. And you know, he's and what she could do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this ordinarily this would be like a breach of confidentiality, but like she gave permission for him to discuss her with me, so And he described it sort of like a split personality. And this was fascinating to hear the Ayurvedic understanding of what we would call mental imbalance. And I said, wow, that really describes her. Did she tell you about her childhood? No. And I didn't think she would. I mean, you go to Ayurvedic doctors,
speak about the child. But
I said, where did you get all that?
He said, from the pulse.
And he said that to really practice Ayurveda, you can't be an ordinary person. You have to have sadhana. You know the word sadhana. You have to have sadhana, you have to lead a very pure life, and then your consciousness is elevated so that you can practice, deal with the pulse in every aspect of the person. And of course, again, this is a whole fascinating field. But the last thing he said was, the last thing I will share with you right now is that, different levels of Ayurvedic practitioners, and this is from Shastra. So one level, it's like, he doesn't really know what he's doing, the practitioner, so you should avoid that category. Then the next level, he knows what he's doing, but he can't explain it. So it's sort of like that category is all right if you can't find someone in the first category. And the first category is someone who knows what he's doing and he can explain it. So you understand what he's doing and why he wants you to do what he wants you to do, and then you're like motivated to follow it. And then, there's like a Sanskrit term for each. And the Sanskrit term for the highest level one is translated someone who can intercede on your behalf with God. In other words, I think he prayed for you. And he also said, and in this case, his lineage, his father, he didn't get all the training in the schools and everything, but he feels he really learned the most from his father. So it was like, if it looks like nothing else will work, his father, and I'm sure it's all supported, it must be supported by Shastra, that tell the patient to chant the name of God. And his father would do that. And, sometimes there would be miracles, the person could get better. And if not, it was still beneficial for the person's mind and soul. So it's very, very integrated. The whole culture. And it's interesting that once I went to visit him with a colleague of mine who was into astrology. And so he asked my colleague, sort of like, how many years have you been studying? How long has it taken you to master the subject? And my my friend said it was like a trick question, because you never master the subject; you always are learning. But there's a whole, it's like all of these different sciences sort of interface with each other. So like from a person's astrology, you can find out about their bodily constitution, their mental makeup, their spiritual position, and you can predict health challenge. It's all interrelated. It's quite amazing. But ultimately, it's all meant to support the essential spiritual practices of bhakti yoga. So
they're supportive, but peripheral, but close peripheral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really, really fascinating. And in some ways this Vaidya, actually when he was small, his father took him, and so he's like quite influenced by Srila Prabhupada, because Srila Prabhupada's edition of the Bhagavad Gita is called Bhagavad Gita as it is, the ideas without compromise. So he was like that. And also Prabhupada made a point that he's not manufacturing any theory of his own, he's just repeating what's in the Bhagavad Gita. So Vaidya Mishra, he's like the same, he supports what he says with sacred texts, and he doesn't compromise. I mean, and sometimes people, they sort of, like if they see you really want to do something, even if they don't agree with it, they sort of go along with it because they think they see you really want to do it. So they were having like the 25th anniversary of the opening of the temple, and I really wanted to come, and they were, and Sridhar Swami was inviting me, and Mr. Sethi, Sridhar Swami even had Mr. Sethi phone me and asked me to come, and I really wanted to come. And so I asked him if I could invite him to come.
Hmm.
And he said no. I was just starting with him. He said, no, you're not ready.
Hmm.
You know, give me a year with you, and I'll bring you to the stage where you can travel to India, but you're not ready now.
Hmm.
So I said, well, what would happen if I did go? And he said, it would seriously set you back in your health. They didn't compromise in other words. And then later I actually felt relieved. I think inside I knew that I really wasn't up to it, but just my mind got fixed on the idea. And it turns out that one of his ancestors was a court astrologer. I'm not sure, I don't remember the name of the king. I think they had like Navaratna. Anyway, so, huh?
He had the Navaratna, like Akbar, huh?
Was it Akbar?
Yeah.
And maybe
he had the nine ratnas.
Anyway, so here's one of his forefathers. He was like the royal astrologer. And he predicted that the king's son would be killed by a boar. And the king did not like that prediction. The boy was like 5 years old. And he consulted a lot of other astrologers. They said, no, it's not true, it's not true, it's not true. So he had his, maybe not Navaratna, but a court astrologer. So he had him arrested and put in jail. And then, the appointed day came. So, they kept the boy inside the palace, and he was like surrounded by guards, and like the day passed, and it was almost time for the boy to go to sleep for the night. And as he was walking in, on the stairs, the royal insignia, which was engraved on a gold or brass flag, like
somehow got dislodged, fell down on the boy's head, and killed him. And there was a boar that the main emblem on that insignia was a boar. So the king realized that the astrologer was right, and released him from jail and apologized. And then because of that, the astrologer got the name Varaha Maher. From that, Varaha means boar. So he didn't compromise. That's the point I'm making. He didn't compromise on what he knew was the truth. And so, Prabhupada didn't compromise either. Anyway, because the truth has its, and of course there are different levels of truth, but it has an intrinsic value. And even if it's not popular at the time, it's still, will prevail. It's like part of the national slogan, Satyam Eva Jayate. It's actually a line from the Upanishads, which means the truth will triumph.
The Indian national anthem?
You all must be hungry, and I don't know, I'm just guessing, but I was told that, are you planning to go to the restaurant?
In some places we can take the shot. Okay, it's closed.
We have
All right. Should we phone them and tell them?
Yes.
It was a really nice... Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, you were a lovely R. We're R, and we'll be even more of a lovely group. It was really a pleasure to speak with you. I will be coming to Chopati tomorrow, but I'm not sure if you would have left.
No, they will be there. They'll meet you tomorrow.
Because they're going to the Echo Village.
Tomorrow evening.
Oh, they're leaving in the evening?
Yeah.
Oh, so then...
They're planning to come tomorrow morning?
Afternoon he is coming for the Sunday feast.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. I won't be in too much separation anxiety. And I can meet you tomorrow. All right, well, look forward to tomorrow, and
this is really nice. Thank you for bringing us up here to Prabhupada's space. This is a sacred shrine in this lineage, and you can feel the vibration here, to share this with you, having been a part of that since that time. And he didn't mention that he had a lot to do with this whole place coming together. So there's no coincidence that we're here appreciating your presence and this sweet story. Bhakti is Ayurveda. Ayurveda is bhakti. Let's see. That was a beautiful story that tied that in. You can't just learn Ayurveda intellectually. It's a love that you have for humanity. Mm-hmm. And this lineage is exemplary of that. This is the ideal of service, the seva and devotion to God in each of us. We feel that. We haven't. It's amazing, we were looking at from showing you the books, the number of books that Prabhupada produced in such a short period of time. It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable just to explain the ideal of service and love to humanity. That's how profound it is.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you share with them, since they're all interested in Ayurveda, the relationship that Krishna shares to the Tulsi plant and its reverence? And
well, the Tulsi plant, I mean, I would prefer to begin by answering more just in the context of bhakti. The Tulsi plant is very dear to Krishna. I mean, that's a big topic of how God in his ultimate feature is a person like us, but not limited like us. But it's a little difficult because our experience of personality in the material world is all limited. All the persons we know have their atma is covered by their physical bodies. We have no experience of a person who's like all atma and no physical body. And also limited, like we're here in Juhu now, so we can't be in Chopati at the same time or Pune at the same time or Los Angeles at the same time. But my God is a person. He has to have all of the qualities we have plus more. So we have the faculty of thinking, of desiring, of speaking, of, so he has all of those faculties. So he also has, just like anyone has likes and dislikes, he also does. But not based on material duality. Like, I mentioned likes and dislikes. So in material duality, we might have friends and enemies. But God has no friends and enemies. But what he likes is devotion. Bhakti, love. And so the Tulsi plant is actually a manifestation of a devotee of Krishna in the spiritual world named Vrinda. And so so Vrinda in the material world is manifest as the Tulsi plant. And it is said that no offering of food to Krishna or Vishnu is complete without the Tulsi leaf. And so any temple, any Vaishnava temple, you'll find that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tulsi is considered to have medicinal properties, which she does have, but so here the two are sort of but it's you know, according to Shastra, Tulsi is meant exclusively for Vishnu. You cannot offer Tulsi directly even to Radha. No, it's only for Krishna. But we can take Tulsi as prasad. So even my Vaidya, he uses Tulsi.
But he, and I told him, unless it's offered to Vishnu first, unless it's prasad, I won't take that medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he would get, sometimes they'll make a whole garland of tulsi leaves and offer it to the deity. So he would get these garlands that had been offered to the deities and use those tulsis. And he doesn't actually use the leaf, but I think he like soaks it. She has amazing medicinal properties.
Mm.
But we won't take tulsi unless she's been offered to Vishnu first.
Mm. Yeah. So much.
Yeah.
Mm. Did Prabhupada speak of the bhavs, the different states of devotion, the moods of bhakti, and how those change in the course of the spiritual tradition as you're evolving in your spiritual path? The mood of devotion, either through service, or as Hanuman, or as the motherly side, the caring side, and the states of thought. Did he ever speak of
that? Oh, yeah. The basic text that describes these different moods or bhavs is called Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which was compiled by Rupa Goswami about 500 years ago.
Mm.
Of course, everything is derived mainly from Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada translated it, not verse by verse, but as a summary study.
Mm.
And so there are like five primary relationships that you can have with the Lord. One is called Shanta Rati, Shanta Bhav, Shanta Ras. That's sort of like, you could say, peaceful adoration. For example, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the material world is like an inverted reflection of the spiritual world. Like whatever we have here exists originally in the spiritual world. But here it's all temporary, subject to decay, and in the spiritual world it's all eternal and blissful. So, we have these different relationships here, and they come originally from God and the spiritual world. And in fact, our desire for relationship can only be perfectly fulfilled with God, because everything here is going to end sooner or later. If for no other reason than the body ends, there are often other reasons, or good or bad, but their relationships have difficulties before then. So, alright, so in the spiritual world, there's just everything we have here. It just comes, it's like a reflection. So, an example of Shanta Ras would be like the trees. The trees give shade.
they give fruits, they give flowers, but they don't. But it's not active in the sense like, yeah, they're sort of stationary. But being stationary, they give service. So that's shanta. And dasya is a servant. And you mentioned Hanuman. Hanuman is like the epitome of the mood of dasya or servanthood in relation to Rama. And then there's Sakya, which means like friends. And this is very hard to understand because to be well, they're reverential friends, but then there are friends who are like equals. And to be a friend like an equal, you have to forget that Krishna's God. And so you've probably heard the term Maya.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Maya means like illusion. So there's actually two kinds of Maya. One is just regular Maya or Mahamaya. Mahamaya makes us forget God and keeps us away from God.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another energy called Yogamaya. Yogamaya that partially reveals God and partially conceals him. So Yoga Maya reveals God's his beauty, his wonderful qualities, his, but it conceals his godhood. Because to be a friend like an equal of Krishna, if you're conscious that he's God, you can't be have that relationship. So Yogamaya comes in. And this is like the specialty, you want to call it, of Krishna. Even with Rama or Vishnu or Narayan, you don't find this. It's just that's not that one is better than another, but it's just that that type of intimate relationship is not there outside of Krishna and Vrindavan. And then there's Vatsalya Bhava, that's like the mood of being a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like the whole, there's one sort of line that is very much in that mood that Krishna's like their child and they're like the parent. And then there's Madhurya Ras, which is relationship with God as like a lover or what.
Mm-hmm.
Now these, especially these higher rasas, are approached with a lot of caution because these states are really only possible when you're liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And being conditioned, still being materially bound, we can mistake these as being material or as just being imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you asked quite an elevated questions, right? Answered, but we generally do approach these topics with care because, like I said, until one gets the sense of the personality of God, right, which is already difficult, one, like I said, take it either as just mythology, just like stories, or as material. But come to think of it, if you look at the pictures on the wall, you'll see them
you see all the different relationships. Like that one, it's a little far, but so that's Krishna, and then his mother is holding him. It's like in the morning, he gets up and she dresses him, and then one of the like servants is also help. He's like down on the floor there helping.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's those two, and well, there are more over here. There's Krishna with his cowherd boyfriends. They go out in the forest during the day and take care of the transcendental cows. And then, well, you've seen Radha Gopinath, Radha and Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Madhurya Ras.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so whatever relationship you want, and because that soul, that Atma, is that's spiritual, that the body changes, but that remains. So that desire is there because we're originally with Krishna, and it can never be satisfied until we're reestablished in our relationship. And we look for it in the material world, but we don't find it. We can have nice relationships with each other, supporting each other in our spiritual quest towards Krishna, but our real hankering for that pure love is only fulfilled in relation to Krishna or